You got enough battery power. Okay. Great. Thank you, Danny. So we're picking up. This may be the beginning. If so, 27th June, we're discussing Son of Man. We're looking at historical layers. We've got the church. Their understanding of Son of Man is human. The title is a title of Jesus to show he's human. Son of God means he's divine. Son of Man means he's human. That's the position of the church, what this term means. The Gospels use the term in many, many places. We'll look at that. We were discussing the Jerusalem church, which is contemporary when the Gospels were written. And so we have Luke, probably early 60s. Mark, mid-60s to early 70s. Matthew, after Mark, our Greek Matthew, written after Mark, although we do have reliable tradition from Papias, who lived in the early 2nd century. So he's recording a tradition that would be like something his grandparents would have told him, that Matthew, the Apostle Matthew, wrote the words of the Lord in Hebrew. And that's interesting because if you were to write a gospel about Jesus in Hebrew and give it a title, it would be Divrei Yeshua, or Divrei Ha'adon, the words of the Lord. That's how you titled a book in those days. So this tradition looks very good. Internally, the tradition looks like it wasn't thought up. It looks like, in fact, it's a real tradition that's being passed on by the Greek church, not realizing that it has internal evidence that says it's authentic. And they were passing it on because they knew it was authentic. So we get double attestation there, the people themselves as well as internal confirmation. Then, but we go back beyond the Jerusalem church would have passed on this information. They would have passed on this Hebrew gospel. And Greek translations of the Hebrew gospel would have been available to our gospel writers. But if you think these written texts have a history behind them, and so this would be called the pre-gospel tradition. It's also, you could say, part of the Jerusalem church. But from the words of Jesus to the time you get these writings, there's a 20, 30-year period. And this would be a pre-gospel tradition. And so that's a layer. And we can go back another layer. Another layer is Jesus himself, Yeshua. Jesus was teaching. So that is a layer of the tradition. What Jesus actually said, what he actually meant. And now there's one more layer, and that is what was already in the culture at the time. What did they already think? Did they use the title Son of Man? What did they think about Son of Man when Jesus was speaking to them? And that affects how you word things also. What you assume your audience knows will affect how you describe things. So those are all the layers. We have the church. We have our written gospels. We have the Jerusalem church. Pre-gospel tradition. We have the sayings of Jesus himself. And we have what was in the culture at the time. All of those
like
are
Daniel 7?
Well, Daniel 7 is part of the written text, but how was Daniel 7 interpreted?
Yeah, that's why I'm thinking it's in the context of the culture.
Well, how was it interpreted in the culture? Right. We'll get to that. Okay. So, now, there have been different interpretations, I've got five basic interpretations. Why is the title, or why is the term Son of Man used in the Gospels? And it's very important to keep these in mind as well. So here come five different approaches. And one is that Son of Man is a title that was used by Yeshua. Now that, I think, is abundantly clear in our written Gospels. The written Greek Gospels definitely have O Uios Tu Anthropou as a title used by Yeshua. There is no doubt about that. Exactly what it meant, we can discuss, but in terms of a fact, it was a title in our Greek Gospels. However, what else have people suggested that it meant? Particularly in German scholarship, they have interpreted the Son of Man as a prophetic reference to somebody other than Jesus who would come after Jesus. That Jesus prophesied about someone who would come. You can find that in the literature. Now, and we'll discuss that a little bit as we have time. That is, that it is a, the Son of Man was a prophecy that an eschatological end time judge would come. Okay?
But not Jesus.
But not Jesus, exactly. That it isn't Jesus, but it's somebody else that would come. Now, that position is, if you're going to quote that position, you need to also remember that that position is based on certain assumptions. And we will come and look at some of those in a minute. Another way that this phrase, the Son of Man, has been looked at is to say, well, in we happen to know that in both Hebrew and in Aramaic, Ben Adam, or Bar Nash, meant anybody. If you wanted to talk about somebody, you wouldn't say this bloke came, this person was walking. In Hebrew or Aramaic of the first century, you would say Ben Adam Ba, a Son of Man came and did this and that. It meant somebody, a human being. But it's just the way of saying somebody. And so...
Somebody.
What?
It still means somebody.
And it's, oh, and it still means somebody. And today we can use both of them. If you're, if you just mean somebody, you say Ben Adam. If you mean somebody and you're being a little bit derogatory, you say Bar Nash. Some Bar Nash was in the market and... making a ruckus.
What's Nash?
What? Bar Nash? It's Bar and Nash. It means Son of Man in Aramaic.
Oh, I see. It's
a,
and you, but it's used in modern Hebrew.
Hebrew as a bit of a one-off.
It's used in modern Hebrew to say, now somebody was doing this, and it means you're going to use him as a foil to say something negative, typically. Now, it doesn't have to be, but it... Would you use word, did Danny run away? Okay, that number four is coming. Someone else has interpreted Son of Man as an idiom that means I. It's a way when I'm talking, like I'm speaking right now, and I would say, the Son of Man is speaking. Bar-Nash is speaking. Yeah, that's Gezer Mesh. He wrote an article in the back of Matthew Black's Aramaic Approach to the Gospels and Acts. It became very famous, and he was arguing that it basically meant I. It was a circumlocution for Jesus to say I without saying I.
Only Jesus.
What?
Only Jesus could use it.
Why?
Would I use it and talk about myself as I?
Well,
that's what I'm trying to say.
That's what Vermesh was saying. Vermesh was saying that this was just an Aramaic idiom for I. This is how you would do it.
At that time.
Okay. And so everybody would recognize that Jesus was just talking about himself because he used this term. However, let me say, that position, I can get rid of that right now. That position is wrong. That is not an Aramaic idiom that means I. And if you look at all of the evidence that he gathered up, you will find that all of that evidence in Aramaic simply proves that it means person, someone, like everybody has always known it meant. It does not mean I, and in fact, when a speaker in Aramaic wants to refer to themselves, like we do, we can your humble servant requests this. We can use third person this way in many languages, and Aramaic had a way of doing that. And they said, Hahu Gavra. Hahu Gavra. That man, meaning me. But you say, that man is teaching this morning. And you mean he, yourself. And you can even use it in a second person, that man. If it's clear that you're, it's the person you're talking to, you can say Hahu Gavra for the second person.
But never I.
No, you can. Hahu Gavra is the idiom for I. Hahu Gavra does not mean son of man. Hahu Gavra means that man, and that's the idiom, not son of man, not Baunash. Hahu Gavra. And if you're a woman, you say Hahi Itata. That woman. Ha'i hit, ha'i itata.
I can't say ha'i.
We're getting to number five. And so anyway, number four is just wrong. But it's out there. People will still quote it. And they, because a famous scholar wrote it, they think it must be it must be a possibility, possibly valid. Well, no, the guy just made a mistake. He's misleading you. There are people that are learned that make mistakes and mislead people, and it's up to you to look at the evidence and say, oh, he made a mistake. And so that one can be dismissed. It doesn't just mean I. Okay. Finally, the fifth position, and it's a very esteemed professor, Zichrono Livracha, who was a close friend of Robert Lindsay, he thought that maybe it means Abel, the son of Adam, because the name Adam and the word person in Hebrew, of course, is the same. And he made the big discovery, not, that in the opening part of Genesis, it says the Adam, where it's talking, God made the Adam, Ha-Adam. And so he thought, oh, well, because we have the son of the man, then it's just talking about Adam, the son of Adam, that's Abel. Now, there is a kernel of truth. These learned people don't go off on wild goose chases without something that triggers it. The truth is that Abel was an eschatological figure in the Jewish culture of the Second Temple period. We have a book called The Testament of Abraham, and in that, Abraham goes to heaven and sees a man sitting, judging, who is this? And then in the book it says, and it, we only have the Greek, but in the Greek it says, this is Abel, the son of Adam, the first formed. It says that twice in that book. So there is this heavenly figure, and think of what it's based on. It's based on the fact that Abel is the first martyr, first human killed was Abel. And so he has the right to judge other people, to judge murderers, etc.
And he was righteous.
What?
And he was righteous.
And he was righteous. So Abel, son of Adam, the first formed. However, I'm going to dismiss this one also. We don't need to deal with this much further. And here is why. It is 100% certain that the Jerusalem church did not understand that this way. Why? Because in Greek, if you want to distinguish son of Adam, Abel, the son of Adam, from just human being, in Greek, the word for Adam is Adam. And the word Adam, and the word for human being is anthropos. So in Greek, you are forced to clarify your position. Do you mean son of Adam, or do you mean son of man? Greek forces the writer to make that distinction. And our Gospels 100% have son of man, 0% son of Adam. So that means that the tradition, the pre-gospel tradition, the Jerusalem church, definitely had the position that this was referring to Son of Man and not Son of Adam. And the evidence for that is that it is 100% in our Gospels, Son of Man.
If you go back, they would say there's an earlier Gospel, an earlier tradition, where it was written in Hebrew, or...
The problem is that it's contemporary with these others. You can't go back. You're already... Our written materials are already coalescing and taking place in the 50s and 60s. So we've got living people. You don't have time to go back and have another gospel and a tradition that gets forgotten, because people were still alive in the 50s and 60s that were alive in the 30s. So that just simply isn't an option. You can't stretch it out and put in generations and have it forgotten. It's there. And it's true that human beings can divide their opinion, but you can't obliterate opinions. That's hard to do. And there is no evidence of Son of Adam. Now, there's another linguistic evidence that also shows it can't be true. Not only historically does it not explain our evidence, but linguistically it doesn't explain it either. And the clue was in that Testament of Abraham I just read to you. Because Hebrew was ambiguous between Adam meaning mankind and Adam meaning Adam, when they wanted to refer to Adam, and they would say Adam HaRishon, the first, HaAdam HaRishon, the first man. This is how you say it in Hebrew. You don't just say Adam, because Adam, that's how you say person in Hebrew. Adam, Adam ba, Adam asad ze. But if you want to say Adam, just like we say Avraham Avinu, Abraham our father, that's the father of the tribe, Avraham Avinu. When you want to mean the father of the human race, you say HaAdam HaRishon, yes? Moshe Rabbeinu, Avraham Avinu, HaAdam HaRishon. And what do we find in this Greek text, this intertestamental text of Abraham, when Abel is being pictured there? He says, oh, this is Abel, the son of Adam, and in Greek it says Adam, but then it says the first formed. And that tells you that very likely this is coming from a Hebrew tradition, which a lot of people have suspected. The Greek has the style of having been influenced by a Semitic language. And so if it's coming from a Hebrew tradition, that explains why it says, Abel, son of Adam, the first formed. Because they heard in the Hebrew text before them, it said, HaAdam HaRishon. And so they had to explain that in Greek, and they translated it, Adam, the first formed. It would have been simply Havel, or Hevel, Hevel ben HaAdam HaRishon. No, you wouldn't have to say that in Hebrew. All you'd have to say is HaAdam HaRishon, done. But in Greek, O Anthropos, O Protos Anthropos, doesn't quite make sense if you don't have that tradition. So they said first formed. Tu protoplastu. Tu protoplastu, that was what they said. Tu Adam tu protoplastu. Now, so the interpretation I is out. The interpretation Abel, son of Adam, is out. What do we have left? Well, we have anyone traditions, the traditions that say it means anyone. That was three. We have the tradition that it's a prophecy about a coming Son of Man, and we have it as a title that Jesus used for himself. And if that, and that's certainly what our Gospels have, we still have to interpret what it means. Now, traditionally, and we're starting to get on the home stretch here, we got 10 minutes. Here we go. Traditionally, people have divided all of these Son of Man sayings into three. We have Son of Man sayings that talk about the Son of Man on earth. Things like, for instance, having the authority on earth to forgive sins. The Son of Man comes eating and drinking. Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Who do you say that the Son of Man is? Now that one, well, I'll come to that. Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? Okay, now, that is the Son of Man on earth. There are another section of these sayings in the Gospels that people have grouped together and called it the suffering Son of Man, where we have the Son of Man must suffer. And there are several repetitions variously said in various contexts in the Gospels. Son of Man came to serve and give his life. The Son of Man is betrayed to sinners. The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of men. The Son of Man risen from the dead. All of these imply a suffering Son of Man. And this is something, of course, that was not in Judaism of the time. And even if you link this to Daniel 7, which we'll come to in a minute, that doesn't explain this suffering aspect. This is surprising. Finally, we have a number of sayings that are called the apocalyptic Son of Man, where it says the Son of Man will come. To remind you, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man. When the Son of Man is revealed, will he find faith on his earth? The Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne. As in the days of Noah, so in the days of the Son of Man. So these are all referring to the Son of Man coming. And those are the three divisions. I'd like to read to you a couple of paragraphs from someone. Let's see, where is it? Okay, one thing that here's a paragraph from George Ladd, who is summarizing what some scholars have done. So pay attention so that you understand the motives and assumptions behind some of these positions. That will help clarify what is fact from what is assumption or hypothesis. Another factor that influences scholarly judgment is the insistence upon formal consistency. That is, they demand that all three of these types of sayings have to be self-consistent, which of course they aren't. Therefore, the apocalyptic coming Son of Man and the fact that the Son of Man is on earth forgiving sins, that's inconsistent. So the scholars will say, because we feel a clash here, they're not both true. One of them we have to throw out. And this is what they do. They will throw out one group of sayings or the other group of sayings, and that means they don't get the full picture. But they will write a book, and people will quote them as if it is the full picture. So let me go on.
Granny, why are we so afraid of tension?
I have no idea, but this is a common... Scholars love to do this. One, it allows them to publish a book and become important. So, if the Son of Man can only mean the superterrestrial transcendent Messiah, then we cannot explain how Jesus, already in his present, could claim the rights of the Son of Man. That's quoting from somebody. Now back to Ladd. He says, the idea of an apocalyptic and an earthly Son of Man are not necessarily mutually exclusive. And this is proven by the fact that the two concepts are brought together in the Gospels. The church, the Jerusalem church, didn't see that as a contradiction. The gospel writers didn't see it as a contradiction. So you scholars who throw out some of the sayings in order to rewrite the saying in your own image need to get down off your high horse. Yes?
Well, I see, you know, this theological ideas.
I have to keep, I'm sorry, I have to keep going. We only have five more minutes.
Allow me a comment. I want to make a comment.
If it's a sentence, okay, but not a teaching. What is
it? No, not teaching, comment, you know. It's the misunderstanding or understanding of Son of Man and Son of God. You know, all the prophets in the Old Testament, they prophesied about a human being, But the attribute Son of God came from the saying and teaching and announcing by Jesus himself, his works, by his miracles.
I have to stop right there.
You know, only
no,
Jesus
please,
came.
I'm stopping you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's exactly what the church taught later. I mentioned that at the beginning, that the church taught that Son of God referred to the divinity of Jesus and Son of Man, the humanity.
Depending on his sayings and teaching.
Okay, but Jesus didn't run around talking about the Son of God this, Son of God that. He talked about the Son of Man. We're coming to that. Now, let me go on. And that was an interruption that is hurting our time. Let me go on now, back to this quote. The idea that the Son of Man might be an eschatological figure other than Jesus, the prevailing view in German theology, is exceedingly difficult because there is no scrap of evidence that Jesus expected someone greater than himself to come. But there is much evidence to the contrary. So this idea that the Germans have grabbed simply has no foundation. It is their own imagination that is being quoted. And so if people quote a German scholar, that German scholar, for instance, may base his scholarship on an assumption that Jesus did not rise from the dead, that there cannot be divine foretelling.
Certain
German scholarship, of course. Yes, there are trends within German scholarship that tried to take out the divine and reinterpret everything without any divine influence.
What?
Anything supernatural. And they said to be historical, we have to throw out supernatural. So if you're going to quote these guys, you have to remember that they are throwing out the supernatural. They are saying that it's impossible, according to their methodology, for Jesus to be the future Son of Man on earth forgiving sins. So they've already, by their assumptions, thrown that out. And so if you quote them to say this proves that something or other, no, that doesn't prove anything. You're simply quoting the conclusion of the guy's very assumption.
You end up with God is dead.
Now, let's come back to this title.
Ready?
Yes. Okay, we're down to 5 minutes. I want to read two things here. We maintain that the one solid critical position is the fact that in all of our New Testament sources, Jesus and Jesus alone used the term Son of Man to designate himself. Form critics emphasize the criterion of dissimilarity. That is, you can only trust that a saying is authentic when we have no parallel in either Judaism or the early church. In other words, when historians go in and they try to evaluate the Gospels, they look, one of the criteria that they use is dissimilarity. In other words, if it's in the Gospels and it's not the church, and it's not Judaism, then it very likely is none other than Jesus himself, because we can't explain it as being put into the Gospel by the church, nor is it just taken over from Judaism. So dissimilarity is a tool that historians use. Let's go on. If this principle is applied to the Son of Man sayings, the idea that the Son of Man would appear on earth in humiliation to suffer and to die has no parallel in Judaism. Judaism did not have a Son of Man that came and died. Or in the early church. The early church did not have a tradition of the Son of Man coming to die, this apocalyptic Son of Man. In fact, this heavenly Son of Man was forgotten in the early church. The Son of Man became Jesus as a human being, and so the first thing you get in the second century is you have this epistle of Barnabas saying, don't call him Son of Man. That's insipid. That doesn't bring any new information. He didn't know. He didn't know what Son of Man meant. Okay. The church often spoke about the sufferings of Christ, but never of the Son of Man. The fact that the Son of Man appears only in Jesus' own words seems to prove conclusively that the title Son of Man must have been truly and incontestably Jesus' own designation of himself. This is bedrock. Although the majority of critics, including Bornkamm, he quotes one of these guys, fail to recognize the force of it. If Jesus did speak of himself as the Son of Man in his earthly activity, then the only compelling argument against the authenticity of the eschatological sayings is their alleged incompatibility with the earthly sayings. Furthermore, it fits the criterion of dissimilarity to apply the idea of an eschatological Son of Man to one already on earth in humiliation. There is, therefore, good critical reason for an open-minded, inductive approach to accept all three classes of sayings as authentic. And I will stand there now. Since I'm closing, let me add a couple more comments. At the layer of writing the Gospels, this term, Son of Man, it's coming from Jesus. And Jesus is using it uniquely in ways that were not used in Judaism. And he's using it heavenly. Instead of Son of God, when Jesus said Son of Man, he meant I'm divine. The phrase
based on prophets and apostles. Don't mention Judaism or the church. Church is people.
Okay, no. Daniel 7.
And prophets. That's all.
Like
no, this is what I
mean. Okay, please understand what I'm saying because you will actually be blessed and you will agree if you understand what I am saying. That when Jesus referred to the Son of Man, he was referring to a heavenly figure. Son of Man did not mean human being. It meant that human being that was in heaven. It was a title built on the book of Daniel, built on a heavenly.
His origin from the old.
Yes, exactly. That's why you shouldn't be objecting to what I'm saying. Understand what I'm saying and you'll agree. You won't be objecting. Now, this is the title that Jesus is using, and once that title is fixed, it explains why the wording in our Gospels is o uios tu anthropou. It's very strange wording. It is a title. One of the things we have not had time here to discuss is how could that title have been used in Hebrew by Jesus? How could it have been passed on and then end up in Greek? But we have ended up with the title in Greek. There was a way for Jesus to do that in Hebrew that made it clear. And then once we have that title, it is possible that in writing the Gospels, where you have to condense everything to put it into a two-hour movie, as it were, that you are going to get composite sayings. So there, it is possible that some of the sayings of Son of Man in the Gospels are the creation. They're true, but they have been put together by the gospel writer in order to collapse and communicate the full message. In other words, to give an example of such what I'm talking about, we have, for example, in Matthew 16, who do men say that the Son of Man is? Well, that's where Jesus is talking with Peter. Who do men say that the Son of Man is? That may be Matthew's way of recording this. Jesus may have said, who do people say that I am? That phrase, Son of Man, may not have been used in that specific place, but it still is true for Jesus to say, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And so Matthew records it one way, Mark and Luke record it in a slightly different way. So I am not saying that every Son of Man saying in the Gospels had to have the phrase Son of Man in that context if you had a tape recorder there. That's not the way history writing ever works. And anybody who's made a movie knows that's not the way movies work either. When you take a person's life and you compress it into a 2 or 3 hour presentation, you have to make sure that people get the point. And that requires fitting things together in a composite picture. So in one sentence, Jesus used Son of Man as a title. It was based on Daniel, but he used it uniquely because he was tying the divine Son of Man with the earthly suffering that the Son of Man would have to die and be rejected and would rise again from the dead. And so what you have in the Gospels is something unique in the history of humanity, where the man from heaven came to earth to die and to be to rise from the dead for us. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you. Absolutely amazing. Thank you.
I can't find
He's here.
But you still have to